Hello kids, welcome to episode 7 of Spinning Yarns with Nick and Paddy, a podcast created by my writing partner Nick Petru and I, Patrick McCarthy. We will be immersing ourselves in the world of the written word and attempting to be as entertaining and as smart-ass as possible. Before we commence, we'd like to acknowledge the traditional custodians of the land in which we meet, the Whadjuk people of the Noongar Nation, and pay respects to their continuing culture and the contribution they make to the life of this city and this region, and their leaders, past, present, and emerging. How the fuck are you, man?
Great. It's been a lovely day. I got a story acceptance this week. I'm fucking flying, man.
Nice.
How about yourself?
Dude. Yeah, I'm feeling good, eh? Yeah, for sure, man. Got a lot of work done as well. Working hard, trying to write as much as possible.
Excellent.
Excited to get into episode 7.
Oh, hell yeah. Cheers,
so,
man.
Cheers, brother. So just to sum up, we'll be doing a short story written by Nick, and an essay and poem written by myself, and just a little bit of discussion along the way as well.
Cool. And with that short story, that was first published in Crow and Cross Keys in January this year, so I just have to acknowledge that.
Sweet. Was it like a horror publication?
They do all sorts of eerie shit. Yeah.
So they suit you?
Yeah.
So to begin with, Widow of the River by Nick Petru. Despite the humidity clinging to the timbers of the port, my bones were numb and my hairs stood as stiff as shipmasts. We lay in Isabella's bed and I rested my head on her breast, certain she held in her all the warmth that was left in the world. Our shadows shuddered in the candlelight, which flashed silver before returning to the colour of mead. My ring finger was starting to go dead. John, my love, you will never leave me, no? Leave you, I said, my words exiting my mouth in walls of steam. Isabella, you know I must go home, but I will return, as always. Why are such thoughts on your mind? Tonight, the moon is full, she said. Always I think of the Widow of the River when the moon is full. You know this story? Yes, I said, pulling the blanket up to my chest. But will you tell it to me anyway? She paused. The city was quiet. Sailors did not stagger past the house, jesting about fish and the red light district, nor did ponies wrap their shoes on the cobblestone. Even the bedrooms above and beside us were without their regular commotion. There was only a faint, rhythmic splashing I could not place. I felt uneasy, as if I were on the sea after a year on land. Above my wedding ring, my finger was completely dead. I twisted the ring until it came off. Then I reached over Isabella and put it on her nightstand. After what seemed an eternal silence, she said, "There is a castle on the river and a lady in its tallest tower. She sings out from her window when the moon is mirrored and full. She sings for her husband, who left her for the other family he had made at port. Her voice is a lighthouse. Everywhere else is cold and dark. Can you hear her, my love?" Isabella started humming a beautiful melody, vibrating my skull like a church bell. Through her rose perfume, I could smell the canals, slightly putrid, as if choked with algae. "I think this is a different story," I said. "Was her husband not claimed by the sea?" Isabella's humming somehow continued as she said, "This is the story as it was. You must listen my love. She rested her arms around my neck. Her husband has yet to come home. Maybe he never will. Who knows? But the lady does not surrender to death, even though she is just hair and bones in a dress. Her desire is strong, and men like her husband must be stronger to escape it. Isabella's arms shut like a pillory around my neck, but I feared to fight her, lest I forfeit her warmth. They row to her island on nights as tonight. Their eyes are open, but they see only a dream. Their bodies are, what is this word? Puppet? Yes, something like this. The boats of the men who rowed before them clutter her shores, stinking of bilge water. There are hundreds of them, and as many wives back home, singing for their own loves lost. The candle stuttered. The rhythmic splashing grew louder, more determined. I looked out the window and did not see the cobblestone streets nor the ruby brothel glow, but a round stone tower with the full moon socketed in its battlement like an imperfect gem. The candle went out. Moonlight poured into the room, washing away the ceiling and walls. When all that remained was the bed, which somehow hovered over the river, I could see the castle in full, down to the boats and the muddy shore. I fell against the headboard. Isabella was gone, her warmth absorbed by the warmth which poured from the tower. A woman's silhouette stood in the tower window, hair swimming in a dark aura around her shoulder bones. Just below the surface of the river, the mud snaked out towards me, clasping my boat and dragging me to shore. I dropped my oars into the rowlocks and floated, gaping mouthed, into the gravity of her voice. John, my love, you will never leave me, no? Leave you? I could not. The end. Dude, nice one.
Thank you.
That's all right, man. Cheers for that, dude.
Cheers.
That was the very first time I've read that, like, out loud or just ever. Reading it. Yeah, exactly, ever. And that was really beautiful. I just loved your wording throughout that whole thing. It was so dreamy, but yeah, definitely it became a nightmare.
Yeah.
Which is traditional for you.
Pretty standard.
Yeah. Nick plunging the fucking darkness of his dreams.
So how did you interpret it?
So initially it just seemed like two lovers lying next to each other in bed, mm-hmm. talking in that sort of, you know, soft, dulcet tone that we all do after we make love, don't we, Nick?
Yes.
We all do that. Especially us. And
after a sausage session, yeah.
Oh, lovely, sure. Lovely. It was my favourite session. But quickly became clear that he's actually a man caught in a dream state and ensnared by this, I guess like some sort of siren. But, you know, he seemed like completely fine with it, like happy with it. Like, or at least maybe content with it. Like, he didn't seem like he was going to fight it at all. Maybe he wasn't too sure what was happening, like we were at the outset.
Yeah.
But especially with the poetry of the language and the ease in which it transitioned from a scene of two lovers to some sort of fantastical nightmare.
Yeah.
we were also transported in the same sort of way. Oh, yeah, I really enjoyed that.
He's like under a spell, I suppose. So he thinks that this is normal. Like, I'm just going to go and hang out with this woman and, you know, cheat on my wife with her. Mm. And then that's the spell like taking place. And then it gets to a point where he cannot break it. And he's like pulled into the light like a moth. No, I really love the language in that one. I think if I were to write a longer story with that sort of flowery, like old-timey sort of language, kind of gothic, I guess, it would probably wear out its welcome. But with potentially. But with short stories like this for a modern audience, you can experiment a little bit more. You can write like that. And I love writing like that. It's my favorite.
You've got a few stories in that sort of vein, that sort of tone. You know, like it feels like it's set ages ago, you know, in this like forgotten time, a time maybe that didn't ever really exist, but it's really fun to teleport readers to that sort of world, you know, and I think that was really lovely, man.
Yeah, I think really it's lovely. Like, for me, I would define it as sort of like gothic fantasy. Like, when I got into reading horror, especially, I came in from through the gothic stories like Dracula and Frankenstein and the original gothic story, The Castle of Otranto. So I was like enamored with that sort of language. I still love it. And then I've got that necromancer story, which I just found out the other day is being published by an Australian magazine called Etheria magazine, which is really exciting. And that's all that sort of language. And I think it really suits the story itself. So I can't wait to share that one on here. Hey?
Cool, man. I wholeheartedly agree. And so now time for an essay. So on this week's segment of Stories We Love, we're going to be talking about a character we love, Bernadette Bassinger, from the 1994 Australian cult classic film, The Adventures of Priscilla, Queen of the Desert. As a self-proclaimed pretentious expert on film and cinema history, I was flabbergasted to discover that I hadn't yet seen The Adventures of Priscilla, Queen of the Desert. Even though I've lived in this country for 15 years and have loved it just as long, for some inscrutable reason beyond my reckoning, I hadn't until recently given Aussie cinema its fair shout. I've steadily been remedying that sad fact these last few years, however, and I've had my eyes well and truly open to some extraordinary artistic experiences, involving, but not exclusive to, road warriors, working class battlers, and hairy, earless maniacs. Having now added soul-affirming drag queens to this eclectic list, I feel like I've taken one fabulous step closer to utter cinematic completion. Released to acclaim in 1994, Priscilla was famed for being way ahead of its time with regards to its themes of sexuality, identity, and gender performativity, but was loved to an even greater degree by audiences local and worldwide for being just a hell good time, eh? Rich, witty characters thrust into the alien outback of their own country, where they fight the unrelenting heat, cruel, prejudiced vermin, and the painful yearnings of their own courageous hearts. It's a classic for so many reasons. The Kraken one-liners, ecstatic dance numbers, Guy Ritchie's rig. But it's the poignancy that sticks with me so doggedly. Watching the effervescent Felicia weep in shock after surviving a violent homophobic attack, or Tick accept his young son's love with tears in his eyes and pride in his voice, are deeply affecting moments that only serve to elevate the material beyond what one could naively assume to be just a chucklesome collection of quick quips and cheap tricks. Make no mistake, this movie's heart is deep and full, a fact no better encapsulated than by Terence Stamp's achingly, show-stoppingly human portrayal of Bernadette Bassinger. The English actor was 56 years of age at the time of filming, and records state that he was initially hesitant to take on the role, as it was unlike anything he had done before. But director Stephen Elliott's casting for the film was nothing short of a stroke of genius. The brooding intensity he was known for in other famous roles wasn't reduced, but refracted through the fascinating prism of Bernadette's riveting characterization, and resulted in arguably the greatest performance of the esteemed actor's career. As a remarkably beautiful middle-aged woman, struggling to find meaning in life and in a career she once ruled, Stamp imbues Bernadette with such striking grace, wisdom, power, and poise that she swiftly becomes the emotional anchor upon whom the stellar performances of Guy Ritchie and Hugo Weaving ultimately rely. Bernadette is begrieved and lonely, with her best days presumed hopelessly behind her, but her witty intellect and awesome dignity brims with such strength that she exudes off-screen in a way few fictional characters can ever hope to. Her elegance is matched only by her hilarity, a delicate balance, brilliantly subverted when she drunkenly falls asleep with her face in a cake, but one scarily disturbed when she is callously dead-named by a cackling Felicia and understandably reacts with an anguished fury. Though a fantastically entertaining film, Priscilla's greatest success is the deftness with which it showcases the expansive humanity of its subjects, with Bernadette Bassinger as queen amongst them, her mellifluous voice and sapphire eyes belying a weary spirit hewn to the bone after years battling adversity and loss. Stamp is extraordinary. We salute you, sir, or we can curtsy, my dear, if you'd prefer. Thanks.
I have not seen that movie.
It's fucking awesome, dude. It's so funny. It's honestly, I watched it like last year, and it's just like a collection of little vignettes of these three drag queens traveling into the heart of Australia to Alice Springs to do a drag show. And like they meet prejudice and everything on the way, but the characters are so richly drawn and so funny and so sensitive and so sensitively portrayed. Like the film is just winning, man. Like it's such a good time.
I agree with you though. Like I haven't really given Australian cinema much of a chance, but there's so much good shit out there. Like the stuff that I have watched has been great. So why don't I pull my finger out of my bum?
Yeah. Why not, dude? I ask you that every day. Pull it out.
It's just been sitting in there.
Pull it out.
It's getting soggy.
Get it out, dude. No, but you're right, man. It's like, I don't know, I just completely forgot about it. I get swept up in watching, like, I don't know, fucking, like, classic Hollywood films or...
Transformers.
Yeah, or Transformers, yeah, like, all the time. But, you know, there's just amazing pieces of art being created right here in this country. And, I don't know, that was just one...
E.G., eh?
E.G. Us, yeah.
Us, what?
Including this podcast called, I think it's Spinning Yarns about Oriental Rugs.
We actually Googled Spinning Yarns, and one of the first things that popped up was a podcast about rugs called Spinning Yarns. So that's what we're doing from now on. This is the last thing to do with literature and stories that we ever talk about.
No more Spinning Yarns podcast with Nick and Patty about stories. It's now about fucking carpets. No, but that was a fun movie to research and write, and Bernadette's an extraordinary character, and everyone should go watch this movie.
You know what we should do, though, next, now? You should read a poem, because everybody loves your poems.
Mm. Thanks very much, man. I shall read a poem. A Lovely Old Man by Patrick McCarthy. When the creeping cold of the everyday seizes my tongue, so I've nothing to say, turns my mind to stone, deadens my skin, and snakes into my heart to plot from within. I steer my soul to thoughts of you, imagining what you would do if you had grown into a lovely old man. Years before your life had even begun, you were ripped from us so terribly young, putting an absolute stop to your clock by cracking your head on that cold London rock. But this is a path I prefer to shun, to picture you not so swiftly undone. I see you recovering from all the shock, life returning to you the power to walk back into your life, to dance with your wife, and the chance to be a lovely old man. On eluding death, you'd have much to say, enough so to scribe some wonderful play in which you alone would take to the stage and imbue with magic your words on the page, where you'd blow the entire cosmos away with an impossibly poignant display of humanity far beyond your age, of an artist and man completely uncaged, a spared soul thirsting for each radiant ray bestowed upon him with every new day. And there I'd sit in front of the stage, hands clasped in thanks that your fate hadn't changed, because you belong by my side, and if you hadn't died, you would have made a lovely old man. I leap forward in time and hear your name, spoken with widespread, respected acclaim. A distant future, where an age has gone by, your dark hair grown ashen and faded blue eyes. Deep wrinkles abound your skinny old frame, loved by a family, and perhaps I've the same. Though still a beauty, no one could deny, the mere mention of sex by then makes you sigh. Our grips on this life beginning to wane, hearts rife with yearning and nostalgic pain. We while out our last days, waiting to die, in twin rocking chairs, on a porch, getting high. Senile or stoned, you can't remember my name. Yet you smile at me, exactly the same. I will always wistfully ponder why we weren't granted the gift of a more timely goodbye. But with you guiding me, I will hopefully be something close to a lovely old man. Thanks.
That's great, bro. Sad and funny. Love that one.
I really liked writing it too, man. Thanks. That was like a big one for me. I was like, my best friend, Jack, died 4 years ago. So October 20th, 2017. And it was just like, it just left like a gaping hole in not only my lives, but like the lives of his family and all of his friends. And he was a very popular guy, very well loved, very beautiful man. And it was just such a tragic loss. And I was writing about him for years, but it was such like a dark, it was from such a dark and insidious point of view, you know, like it was all so noxious. It was like so noxious that it was really hard to write, you know. It was like, fuck, there's just no end to this sense of loss. But I think sometime in the last year, I think when things in my life started to come together, when I was maybe a little bit, I maybe evaded like that really black nimbus cloud of grief and started putting things together in my life, I was able to touch on the more beautiful aspects of our friendship and, you know, reclaim them for my own. And it helped me write that. And I think that's helped me come to terms with my grief, you know, and that's a really nice one to perform. I think people really resonate with that one or it resonates with them. Sorry. I remember like, I finished it on a train and it was like 4 PM and the train was packed, dude, like packed. And I finished it on there. And as soon as I wrote, like, I got to like the last six lines and I knew them all in my head. Like I hadn't written them down, but I knew what they were. And I just instantly, I think I made like a very audible, I was like, and just choked on tears. And dude, I was like trying to hold it together on this train. My glasses were up. I was just sitting there taut, like 15 minutes. Like this lady tapped me on the shoulder because I think I was just making this noise. Like, she was like, are you okay, bro? And I was like, yeah, I'm fine. It was pretty funny. But yeah, anyway, I'm happy to share it on the podcast. Nice. I hope everyone enjoyed it.
I think after that, probably get straight into our quote for the week.
Well, yeah, man. Yeah,
absolutely. Actually, we should talk about a few things. We're releasing our episodes every 2 weeks.
Okay.
So on Sundays. And then as we improve in our process and hopefully get a little bit of funding, then we'll be able to move to once a week.
Send us money.
Yeah, please do. I think we did talk about this last week, but anyway, this is another plug and we're shameless about it. Mum, come on.
Mummy.
Pull your weight here.
My mummy is so beautiful. And man, my daddy is so lovely as well. Oh, by the way, just while you're there, do you mind sending us some money for this? That'd be so nice.
But yeah, we've got a Buy Me a Coffee link on our website. So if you go to our website, spinningyarnspodcast.com, you'll find all that shit there. It's all there.
And we're releasing episodes on Spotify and YouTube, and we've set up an Instagram for it as well. So we're going to try and like be more regular with the posts and, you know, build up a bit of anticipation for the episodes. Maybe a little bit more of a communal feel so everyone can get involved.
Yeah.
And yeah.
Twitter. Yeah, and Twitter. Well, that's it. That's what we're going to use the social media for, is so we can interact with our community, because otherwise it's one way. We do the podcast, we record it, nobody can respond to us unless they go to YouTube comments. So having the Instagram and the Twitter and all of that set up means that we can talk to you guys. We're also going to do like a mail list as well. So you can subscribe to that and just get all updates straight into your inbox.
Yeah, sure. And that's been like the best thing about doing this so far, just seeing how people are reacting to it, you know, getting nice messages about it and people laughing at the stupid shit we say. And that's like, you know, building our anticipation every single time we sit down to record. Like really, really, this is really fun. And obviously I'm also just really drunk as well. all right, yeah, so the quote, forgive the rustling of pages. It's not so much like a quote from any particular artist or anything, but every time I come to Nick's house to record this podcast. And again, we're recording in his fucking laundry room. Like, I'm sitting here in front of a really nice microphone, and to my left is the washing machine. But every time I'm coming up, I take the bus to Murdoch Station and the train from there to the city. And there's a big mural with black cockatoos and a beautiful sunset painted on the side of the freeway there going down Leech Highway or South Street anyway. And there's a little haiku there, although Nick is in argument whether it's a haiku or not.
It ain't a haiku, and if you think it is, it's not a good one.
He loves his haikus, but it's a beautiful little poem anyway, so here you go. Shut up, Nick. Feather floating high, caught on winds of change and time. What new dawn will come?
It's not a haiku.
Thanks, guys.